Today's program has been brought to you by Many Kitchens, the one-stop shop for all things foodie. Discover the best artisanal foods that America has to offer. Shop for more at manykitchens.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Listening to Eat Your Words. I'm your host, Kathy Arroway, and we're here at Heritage Radio Network at Roberta's Pizza as usual. And it's a crisp fall day. It's one of those perfect days for cooking something slow, simmering on the stove. And it's a great week for that because this Tuesday actually is the launch of the Gramercy Tavern Cookbook. It's the first cookbook from the acclaimed restaurant, Gramercy Tavern, and its chef, Michael Anthony, is, by the way, the 2012 recipient of the James Beard Award for Best Chef in New York City. He has also been the executive chef at Blue Hill at Stone Barns, and he's actually in the station right now. How are you, Michael?
Hi, Kathy. Glad to be here.
Thanks so much for joining us, and congratulations on this cookbook. It's a beautiful book just out from, well, it's going to be out from Clarkson Potter.
So. It'll be out tomorrow. Tomorrow is the release date.
It's really beautiful, and it's also very practical. And it seems like that may be a little bit counterintuitive to what you might expect.
Well, you know, it's funny. I think when chefs do cookbooks, I first of all, personally, I was a little, I had a hard time getting to the point in my career when I thought I would actually do that. And, but it turned into a great way to tell the story of Gramercy Tavern. That story hasn't been told before in book form. And so I was super excited to, you know, be able to, tell that story, the creation, the ideas behind the restaurant, the people who built it, the kind of artwork that went into it. There were so many firsts with that restaurant. And then really to focus most of the book on the people who work there now and the food that we serve there now. And I think that, you know, the book ultimately kind of tells the story of the evolution of the restaurant.
Very cool. So speaking of firsts that the restaurant sort of pioneered, I've attended many different Grow NYC functions, accompanied some tours, and one thing that I frequently hear from organizers when they explain to others the growth and the success of shopping locally in the green markets is that they couldn't have done it without the support and the participation and the patronage of chefs and restaurants like Gramercy Tavern. I think they usually mention Gramercy Tavern.
Yeah, well, for sure. I mean, if you look at the growth of Union Square, and when Union Square Cafe was built in the mid-80s, it was, you know, it quickly set out as its mission to play a dynamic role in its neighborhood. Mm-hmm. And I think it was amazing to look back now and see what Danny's vision has produced. Mm-hmm. So that connection that Danny and Michael Romano at Union Square Cafe built with the Green Market just a half a block away, they still hold their monthly market breakfast where they'll invite someone from the market in, a producer into Union Square Cafe, cook and tell their story. So there was that intimate relationship that happened. And then, you know, between the mid 80s and now, we also saw this kind of fierce, participation from restaurants of all kinds.
Yeah.
There were some restaurants that considered it more important to be near the airport than near the market.
Mm.
And I think, you know, defiantly, most restaurants have said now that by shopping at the market, by making those personal connections, by using ingredients that are grown close to home, there is a more powerful way to tell our story.
Mm.
So when Tom and Danny built Gramercy Tavern and It was just three blocks away from the Green Market. That was intentional. There was mm-hmm. they were for sure looking to build on the that connection. And Tom has been a strong supporter of the Green Market since the first days of Gramercy Tavern. And in the last 7 years, we've been able to, you know, to take that story and run with it. We have the luxury of having a remarkable man on our staff named Modesto Batista, who's featured in the book. Mm-hmm. And at this point, for anyone who, you know, who takes strolls or shops at the market or enjoys restaurants in general in New York City, that he's an iconic figure. So he is our chief
forager.
Well, his title is chief steward.
Okay.
And so he has a number of responsibilities, like a lot of restaurant organizations. He oversees our porter team and dishwashers and manages their schedule. But his primary purpose, and I think his main love in life, is to be able to shop at the Green Market. Mm-hmm. And he organizes our runs 4 days a week, multiple times a day, and you can't miss him. He's a 6 foot. six foot two inch man who has our hybrid wheelbarrow making his way in and out. And you know, when I contemplated the idea of working at Gramercy Tavern, one of the first things that came to mind was, man, that guy's gonna be on my team. so it's a real luxury. But then, you know, if you look at you know, restaurants across New York and across the country now, we know that it's not a passing, you know,
trend.
Yeah, it's not a fad. This is a defining characteristic in the way we eat. And one of the most important aspects of it is that I think a lot of restaurants in New York that do really well at saying that, look, this is not an exclusive nature between a restaurant and producers. This
right.
is all about kind of creating enthusiasm and showing people that you can buy your food here. You have the best selection of the freshest food, and you have the people right in front of you who are responsible for growing it. So the way we source food at the restaurant is the same way that I source food at home, mm-hmm. in the same way that anybody who walks through the doors at Gramercy Tavern can source their food. And I hope that, you know, what this book does is not simply point out that we have access to amazing food here in the Northeast, but it's kind of a welcome mat. It's a bit of an invitation for people around the country and even whoever gets their hands on this book around the world. It's an invitation to treating themselves to the pleasure of eating fresh, vibrant food.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know a better way to get it other than to go out and ask your friends and neighbors, or go to a green market, or you know, go straight to a farm. It's ironic, my parents are sitting right outside the window here. They live in Central Ohio.
That's
and
so great.
That's the advice I give to mom. It's like, go knock on your mm-hmm. neighbor's door, go to the green market, ask questions. Like that, those kind of interesting plants are out there. People are growing them. There is a newfound interest and a growing you know, economy.
And one of the things I hear from farmers too, because I know you have a great relationship with so many different farmers that you source for the restaurant, is that it's sort of like it's been a symbiotic relationship in terms of like the evolution of what they grow, and that there's been a newfound interest in different heirloom varieties, for instance, and there's been influence just back and forth.
Right. So, you know, as you see chefs travel around the world and become more connected with our colleagues from everywhere, you know, ideas bubble up faster. And mm-hmm. when you can share those ideas with the people who grow the food and ask questions about a particular variety or a particular breed of animal, you know, there's a dynamic dialogue there.
Mm-hmm.
And so what we've also seen in the last few years is not necessarily, you know, a pretentious story where a chef turns around and says, grow this, grow that. but it's more like, hey, what works well on your farm? What is mm-hmm. your story all about? What's the history of your family or your business, and what could we grow? And so that's, I think, a much more interesting story of having that back and forth. You know, I'm a chef. I do what I do in a kitchen, but mm-hmm. the people that we buy from are farmers. So I don't really want to suppose that I know more about their business than they do. So I ask questions, and I think that's the biggest thing, is coming up with the right questions.
That brings up a thought of, that I had about, you know, there seems to be a little bit of a chicken. What came first, the chicken or the egg? Because obviously, with the influence of your restaurant and other great pioneering restaurants and new American cuisine, local cuisine, local food sourcing. It has a great ripple effect on everyday consumers, and it's great because that means more support for the farms, local farms, and more people get to keep their land, and everyone's eating more healthy, perhaps. But who's like, where does this start? Like, what are who was it? The farmers first? Was it you? Was it restaurants first? Was it are there leaders that help inform your decisions?
Well, if you look at the history of the green market, it was there, you know, since the early 70s. And so it's a matter of the way we look at our surroundings. So I think that there are, you know, it's like any kind of field. It really gets reinterpreted by new generations of people. And so if you look at the space that we're sitting in now, the garden is over our heads.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's all about this relationship and being, you know, first making food a priority. Second, it's about taking that initiative to go out and look hard for it, not just accepting what's easiest in life and what's on the supermarket shelves, but going out there and asking those great questions to try to, you know, to make really it's all about making food a celebratory moment.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you have a boring week in the middle of a nondescript month and, you know, everyone's stressed with the normal pressures of life. But when you have something delicious, you know, waiting at home or things that you're going to cook with your friends and family, and you spend a few more times just connecting with the world around you rather than, you know, rather than logging on, you can, you know, tune into the kitchen. I think that there is something really powerful about making food that one of those, you know, priorities in life that brings pleasure.
Right.
It's all about kind of reconnecting with the sensorial pleasure of doing something, cooking something cool and delicious and making something with your hands.
Right.
You know, sharing some information with people who have similar interests. So, you know, I think fortunately we are living and working in a time when so many people find that important.
Maybe nature and the environment started it all.
Well, I think it's all about reconnecting. We're at a time in our society when reconnecting is really important to a lot of people, and food is just one way to do it. It happens to be what I've decided to do for a living, and so we've tried to share that through this cookbook. But we had to share that in a very particular way. If we're going to get people to be enthusiastic and feel good about cooking, we want to make sure that we present it in terms that they understand. And that's not dumbing down the food from Gramercy Tavern. I mean, every chef will say they cook simply, right? I mean, that's a very, the most common heard expression about describing one's cooking. But at the restaurant, we have to recognize that, you know, we have a staff of 180 people. So we work hard at refining what we do, but there are a lot of hands to make it excellent and to make it feel effortless. The reality of it is we all know whether we're cooking for ourselves or a friend or a family, it's tough to be a cook. It's really hard. It's even hard. It's very hard. It's probably hardest to be a cook at home. You know, you put a lot of thought, a lot of work, a lot of hopes and dreams into a meal, and you have to sit right down there and look at somebody you're eating with and say, do you like it?
Mm-hmm.
You know, was it worth the time? Did, you know, was it fun and exciting? And ultimately, especially when there's kids involved, you know, no accolades or wearing a chef jacket around the house makes it any easier. You know what I mean? I have three daughters, and so
what tastes good.
Yeah,
that's really,
you got to win people over on a very flat playing field.
Mm-hmm.
And so we try to do that with this book. We want more people to cook, not simply for people to admire Gramercy Tavern. It's a beautiful restaurant, and I feel so lucky to be in the position to be the steward of that restaurant. But at the same time, you know, we want for people to pick up that book and hopefully cook more intuitively.
Mm-hmm.
That this gives them some ideas of here's how we approach cooking, and here is a sketch of how we would do it at home. The main difference is at Gramercy Tavern, obviously, we have a professional kitchen with lots of talented cooks.
Yeah, it's totally different.
At home, you're usually alone, right?
Right.
And so the number of pans that I'm willing to use at home is nothing like at work.
The, I like
the
how
number
you
of pans,
say that,
the plate.
That you really, really factor in how much cleanup there will be.
Yeah, I mean,
when you decide to make something at home.
I mean, I think everybody who cooks at home thinks
probably
of that.
Do more often. I'm like, oh, I'll think about that later.
So that aspect of writing the book was definitely the hardest. We wanted to be true to the spirit of the restaurant, and we definitely want, you know, for people to feel inspired by, you know, for everyone who's had a hand in building that restaurant, and for everyone who's ever eaten there, we want for them to feel really connected to to the food and the people. But at the same time, I hope that this is a book that lives in people's kitchens, that they'll, you know, either it'll
this
be a book
that's... not just a coffee table book.
Yeah, right. It'll look beautiful. It'll be a great gift. But we want for it to be, you know, we want for it to be used. Some people splatter it and tatter it. Other people read it and then close it and then go cook, you know, with that idea in mind. So whatever way it works for folks at home, I just hope people use it.
And I can't wait to use it because the fall recipes, you know, I usually have a little bit of a creative hiccup when we head into a new season. Not sure quite what to do,
yeah,
how
gotta
to get started.
Yeah, you got to get revved up with a new setup.
So, yeah, you just kind of sink into a new cookbook, even just, you know, reading the pictures before, or reading the pictures. Yeah. You know, taking a look before you fall asleep and then dream about something later. It's just inspirational.
So that book is organized in seasons. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that's the way I tend to think about food. And so it seemed just natural that we would do that. And so, you know, I see you flipping through the fall section there. This is one of the greatest times of the year to cook. And the restaurant has this natural pull, right? When it smell that smoky aroma wafting through the neighborhood, you kind of know right where it's coming from. And it's easy to translate that at home, even if you don't have, you know, a wood burning oven and, but the ingredients are vibrant and colorful, and you know, we start to ease into this cooler weather, which we're seeing this week here in our part of the country, where we see the, you know, kind of full swing, the squashes, the cauliflower.
Actually, the farmers all say fall is the best time of year because you have all these amazing, you know, brassicas are now like really fresh.
Yeah, we try to transform some of those hard to use vegetables into cool and easy dishes,
right,
like the spaghetti squash and sherry sauce that's served with the porgy that you're looking at. It's a simple dish that came with a little trial and error, and we found a combination that is surprising but not difficult to make at home.
I want to get back to the porgy and some other ingredients throughout this book. We're just going to have a quick little musical interlude, and we'll be right back chatting more with Michael Anthony from Gramercy Tavern.
You are listening to When It Was Wrong by the California Honey Drops on the HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
Well, I remember, baby, when we were still in school, all the good times that we shared are breaking all the rules. I'm trying to find a place with no one around. I'm trying so hard.
ManyKitchens.com, you can enjoy decadent caramel brownies, hand-picked teas, and fair trade coffee, oven-roasted chicken pot pies, and so much more. Whether you're planning a dinner party, sending a gift, or just want to try something new and delicious, Many Kitchens offers something for everyone. Help support small batch producers while you discover the best in artisanal foods from across the nation at ManyKitchens.com. Many Kitchens, the one-stop shop for all things foodie.
One look was all it took, girl, and I knew it was my chance. So I came on over while he was gone. Nobody but you and me, baby.
All right, we're back with Michael Anthony, and the Gramercy Tavern cookbook is out tomorrow from Clarkson Potter. So in the beginning of your recipe for lightly curried sweet peas and scapes and ramps, I love how you write that luxurious cooking has traditionally meant truffles, caviar, and foie gras. But at Gramercy Tavern, we redefine luxury as the delicious progression of seasonal ingredients, like sweet peas. And it seems that you might have taken a lot of risks and challenges in, you know, utilizing these new luxury ingredients and presenting them in a context where people might be expecting these, you know,
fancy foods.
Foie gras. Yeah. And kind of introducing new, like your porgy recipe. Also, you said that, you know, porgies usually looked at by chefs as not such a fancy fish, and
right,
but you strive to use it because it's something that is locally available.
Right, there are a lot of themes that are kind of packed in that notion of, you know, trying to redefine luxury cooking. Mm-hmm. And that's a little bit of a grandiose statement. But what it really is just trying to pinpoint what makes for, an exciting meal. And whether that's in a restaurant setting or at home, I've always found it really great wherever I travel to taste things that are, you know, from that place. Mm-hmm.
Rare and unique.
Well, whether it's rare
place.
Or it's, you know, what common in that place, okay. It may be strange and new to
right.
to a traveler, but you know, I like to, yeah, I think that's one of the most exciting ways to experience someplace new. And
right.
so that's really what gets translated into that comment of, like, we want to cook with modest ingredients that come from here, mostly that are grown by people we know.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, it's the kind of simple ingenuity or just slight innovative touch or an interesting combination or maybe a new technique that goes into handling those modest ingredients with care.
Mm-hmm.
Really boils down to just giving them the value that they deserve and recognizing that there's a story behind those ingredients that, you know, we may have grown up somewhat indifferent to, and in, you know, our commodity world, we've made them into being, you know, widgets.
Right.
But
so giving them the spotlight that they really do deserve.
And giving them a name, you know, so
right.
the idea of naming a particular variety is not about the pretentiousness of, you know, trying to fool people into thinking that they should like it because
mm-hmm.
it's, you know,
it's
rare
local,
or something, but
yeah.
it's kind of like finding the names for the food that we eat. That seems like a pretty natural and exciting way of exploring the subject to me. And that's really what happens at Gramercy Tavern, is we take and focus our story on those ingredients. And, you know, some of them might be strange to people. I mean, a fiddlehead fern is pretty cool when you look at it. And if
mm-hmm.
you're not used to eating fiddlehead ferns, I can see how that looks like a really foreign ingredient. But the reality of it is that if we kind of take a look at the world right around us, wherever it is that we live, all of these cool foods are there. They've been there. They've been there forever. And we've just kind of chosen to ignore them
mm-hmm.
for a while.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, in that dish that you mentioned, the English peas, lightly curried English peas, we've tossed some fiddlehead ferns and some garlic scapes. So there's a little discovery involved in that dish for some folks who may not be used to eating those things. And for those of us who, you know, look at them as a real trumpet of springtime, then, you know, then it's more nostalgic than anything and feels like that connection. So I think food resonates with people for different reasons, and for me, it's all about just giving reverence to those kinds of ingredients and making sure that we say something about it. I think a good cook is one who always cooks with intent and
mm-hmm.
has, like, I mean, there's another side of that, is behind every chef, there's a show-off, right? So there's always, a cook is always someone who's expressing something through the food they make. And, you know, the food at Gramercy Tavern and the food in the Gramercy Tavern cookbook is meant to be accessible. It's not meant to shock or surprise anyone. It's meant to be lovable. And those ingredients are all ingredients that, you know, that we found easy enough from local sources. We did not have to, you know, search the four ends of the globe to
mm-hmm.
to find them. They tell a story. So in a way, like, just the sheer their appearance in the book tells a discrete story of, you know, what we're thinking about
mm-hmm.
in a particular time of year.
Now, and when you use an ingredient like fiddlehead ferns, there is quite a ripple effect. You know, when a restaurant like Gramercy Tavern, they're sort of seen as a leader amongst other chefs and restaurants, and then soon more people are using fiddlehead ferns. So how much of a responsibility do you feel when you choose these ingredients?
It's an interesting comment. We saw a backlash this year in terms of foraging ramps. And so I think the restaurant is ultimately responsible for those trends, and not, you know, not that I think everyone follows
Corgis.
Gramercy Tavern's
Corgis
lead.
Corgis are going to get
but it's a big
endangered.
Restaurant that has a wide fan base. And I do think that, you know, for example, in terms of ramps, we decided to cut back our usage of the ramps
yeah.
just to make sure that the people that we're buying from weren't necessarily overpicking
mm-hmm.
from an area, because ultimately we recognize that, you know, those are wild foods, and if they are over-harvested, then we may not have access to them. So a porgy is the same story. We're using a fish that may not be familiar to everyone around the country. But that is a fish that tells a story, a very intimate story for people in the Northeast who grew up fishing, you know, that for that mm-hmm. off of the dock with a little bobber. You know, those mm-hmm. were, that's a very nostalgic fish. And the other side of it is that it's, for the most part, it's bycatch, and it's a great sustainable choice. And then lastly,
and
or maybe firstly,
too.
It's an awesome tasting fish.
I don't
exactly.
understand. It's a perfect size to work with. I love it.
So, you know, the thing is that none of these recipes are dependent on the one ingredient that's highlighted.
Yeah.
If you don't have access to porgy, or, you know, your fishmonger can't get it, or you can't catch it, it's like use a sea bass. Black sea bass is a readily available fish in most parts of the country. And I hope that people will easily make those steps. Like I wanted to softly tell the story of how thoughtful a seafood program we have at the restaurant without hitting people over the head with information. So there's a nice kind of easygoing suggestion of try a fish you may not be familiar mm-hmm. with, like porgy, because it tastes awesome and it's a sustainable choice. But at the same time, if you can, I still want you to cook the dish, but use a fish that you're comfortable with.
And speaking more about proteins, and these buying decisions are you know, very important. And I know you've been a huge supporter of Heritage Foods and also the No Goat Left Behind program,
yeah.
which was, you know, a mission-based initiative to put goat in front of, you know, people's get it on their national appetite a little bit more.
Listen, and I have to admit that, yeah. you know, I did not grow up eating goat, and I was not familiar with cooking goat. And it was a couple years ago through Heritage Foods that we discovered the pleasure of cooking mm-hmm. and eating goat. And it was so much more delicious and approachable and flavorful than I ever expected. And we've become huge fans of it. We serve it in the tavern, the front room of the restaurant that's, you know, open from noon straight through till the end of the night. And there's a menu there, not a tasting menu, because that I call it the today menu. It's all about if you want to sit down and let us make a suggestion of here's what we're crazy about mm-hmm. on a particular day. And so for the last week and a half, 2 weeks, we've featured that goat on that menu because it just feels like now is the time of year that we have it and we want to celebrate it. It's delicious. It's crazy good when it comes off of the wood burning fire. Goat does not appear in this cookbook, but there are other ingredients like the braised shoulder of lamb mm-hmm.
that
are very similar. And, you know, we served it on an emerald green broccoli puree. So those are all things that are accessible to most
Absolutely.
Folks.
Absolutely. And, you know, lamb is one of those ingredients that have long been seen as a luxury ingredient. So here's goat as an alternative.
It is a perfect and easy step for most people to make. And if people, you know, if it's a discovery for them, then we're doing something right at the restaurant.
Awesome. So what makes this cookbook, Gramercy Tavern Cookbook, different from a lot of other cookbooks out there?
Well, it's so much more than just a cookbook. It really is the story of the restaurant, which is a beloved restaurant in New York City. It's going on 20 years of operation, which is amazing
history,
to
yeah.
think about. I mean, in restaurant years, that is more than a lifetime
for
most restaurants. It tells the amazing vision of Danny Meyer. I couldn't believe when I read his introduction to the book how honest and true it was mm-hmm. and how insightful it is. You learn, whether you've been a fan of the restaurant for years or you're just discovering it, you learn so much about the original vision for the restaurant and how it's evolving and how new people who come to that story are working in this timeless setting. There's an essay with the architects, Bentel and Bentel.
Yeah.
And I had a chance to tell them just last week, thank you for creating this timeless setting that, you know, as new generations of people come to this restaurant and bring fresh ideas, that we're able to, and very comfortably able to, you know, to deliver those in that structure that they built. Not only is it practical and it keeps working really well, you know, it's a setting for food that is much different now than it was originally. So I feel really lucky that we get to work in that setting. So it also, the book highlights the people who work in the restaurant. So you have essays by Kevin Mahan, the general manager and partner of the restaurant, Juliet Pope, who's the hardest working and one of the most talented beverage directors in the country. You get to hear from Roberta Ben-David, who's the florist in the restaurant responsible for those amazing arrangements that, you know, that are breathtaking on, in every single season. So you hear from so many people, from, you know, from the owner of the restaurant on down to the sous chef and even the, you know, the chief steward. We hear from Modesto, from his point of view of shopping in the Green Market. And I think that it is a behind the scenes look at one of the most magical restaurant families. Yeah.
So thank you so much for all your time here. And, you know, it's been just really inspiring getting to see for the first time, a cookbook from Gramercy Taverns. And it's one that I'm sure will be very much enjoyed throughout this fall and holiday season.
I'm glad you like it.
Just came out. And any one favorite recipe from the book that you might have?
Well, you were just looking at this butternut squash chowder with peppers, and I think this time of year is explosive and easy. I just wanted to say that I'll be with Danny Meyer and Dorothy Kalins Friday evening,
yeah,
at the Strands, if anybody wants to come out. We'll also be at the Green Market on Saturday morning signing books, so
Union Square.
Love to show it off.
All right, so check that out, and also just check out the book. It's out tomorrow from Clarkson Potter. Thanks again for joining us, Michael Anthony, and we'll see you next week on Eat Your Words.
Ooh, I like the way you do.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.